Welcome to the East Traumacast. This program was brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Advancing science, fostering relationships, and building careers. Now, on to the Traumacast.
Before we get started, I'd like to say thank you to Humanetics for their generous and unrestricted grant for the Educational Resources Committee and Traumacast.
My name is Tatiana Cardenas, and I am here with Dr. Ben Zarzar, our incoming East president. First of all, congratulations in advance for the coming year and your president-elect past year. And thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us.
Yeah, thank you very much. Happy to do it.
First, just a broad question. What drew you to East initially?
I think I had a lot of friends that were involved in East, but ultimately I felt like it was the first step for an academic trauma surgeon. At the time, there really wasn't a gateway into the AAST or any other community, so people like me, I didn't have anybody to hang out with, so East was the place where we did that, and that's why I initially started coming. That plus my mentors encouraged me to get involved, and that was the first step, and that was probably when I was a fellow, or not too long afterwards.
And what kept you coming back to the organization and continuing to be involved? What kept you here?
The people, really, more than anything else. As I mentioned, I found like-minded folks. We started working on things that we all were passionate about. And then that helped us to stay engaged. Honestly, like, I just enjoyed coming to the meeting and hanging out with my friends and then working on really important stuff with them. So that's what kind of kept me coming back. I didn't honestly have any thought that I would ever ascend in the organization at all. I just thought the work was fun, and I thought that the things we were working on were important. And that's why I kept coming back and how I stayed engaged through the years.
My next question is around your vision for the organization in your coming presidential year. What are your thoughts? What do you have in store for us?
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world right now. Healthcare, the nation, the world, obviously a lot of challenges. And I think when you're in that space, when we learned in COVID, it's certainly a challenge. So I don't really like the idea of resilience. I think we need to think more than that. And we need to be able to create systems, people, ways to help our patients that grow from adversity. So not just bounce back to where they were before. Mm-hmm. We need to get better. And that's how trauma systems and trauma centers are set up. We learn from our mistakes, and we're supposed to get better and continually improve. And I think that's the onus, but it's a little more than that. So when we think about that, what are ways we can operationalize that in the organization? So there are various ways we can do that. I'll give an example. So we have this program, InvestC, for research, sort of incubation, and we call it the hackathon. And only two or three people have moderated it in its entire existence the last 8 years. So we need to create redundancy there. If that's a single point of failure, something happened to those folks, then it wouldn't work. So we've got to make that better. So there's other things in the organization that we need to make resistant to change, and maybe even resistant to pressure, and maybe not just resistant to it, but thrive on the pressure. So that's one thing. We need to help our people thrive on the pressure. I think we know that's a problem. And you heard a lot about it, I think, today at the East meeting or this past week. But the folks need to be able to thrive on the pressure. And we need to help people develop the tools to do that and support them with it. So I think that's another area of focus. And then the other piece would be measuring impact. So what has East done? And what does it do? And then telling people about what the hell we're doing. I think that we're so involved in what we're like creating new things and making new work, which I think is great, but measuring the impact of what we've done, we really should take the time to do that and then tell everybody about all the great things that East does for the members, for patients, and then measure that in some way. So I think that those are the top two big picture things, and then there's a lot of little things that happen inside of that, both those areas to help push things forward. The other big thing that I think will happen this year, we've been avoiding, I wouldn't say avoiding, maybe that's the wrong word. We've been tiptoeing around advocacy because of the 501c3. And we're going to take a really hard look at how that looks for us and what we can and cannot do. Also figure out how we can be in that space, but be in it in a way that it'll be meaningful for the members and help our patients, our world, and then also protect the organization from any kind of tax consequences or anything like that. So we need to have some super smart people thinking about that, and we're going to do that this year too.
Awesome. That sounds great. Growth through adversity, measuring impact, spreading the word about us, and taking a deep dive into advocacy. That sounds fantastic. I look forward to the year coming. Thank you so much for your time. And again, congratulations.
Yeah, sure. No problem. And hope everybody enjoys being a member of EAST. And if you have any concerns or questions or want to get involved, just email me.
Awesome. Thank you.
Dr. Goldberg, thank you so much for that very inspiring talk you gave today. Can you tell me, if you had to give two pieces of advice to young trauma surgeons, what would they be?
I think I would first let them know that even though we've all been really well trained, that coming out as an attending early on can be very stressful and the learning curve can feel very vertical, and that they should anticipate that and not be afraid to reach out to their more senior colleagues and to be patient with themselves.
And what do you think has been the secret to your longevity in trauma and at Temple?
I would say that number one is the mission of Temple, which is service to our community. I think I'm very dedicated to that, and I've been so fortunate to work with great trauma surgeons such as yourself, Dr. Dower, but really work with great trauma surgeons and our surgical residents and our students and our community, and it was just a place I never wanted to leave.
Hi, my name is Tatiana Cardenas. I'm talking to our Oriens essay competition winners, Dr. Jennifer Brewer, who was the resident winner, and Dr. Samin Golestani, who's the fellow winner. Both of your talks and essays were filled with a lot of personal and heartfelt stories, tragic stories about why you wanted to be a trauma surgeon, but they were accented and topped with a lot of hope for the future. Can you guys both comment on that?
So I'm Jen Brewer. And I think talking about this and writing about my story, I think we all, as trauma surgeons and trainees, realize that when bad things happen or tragedies happen, we always feel the need to do something. And I think that's kind of what I took away from everything that happened in my story in Sandy Hook, that I remember right afterwards, we all felt the need to do something, to help people. And I think that feeling goes forward going into trauma surgery.
I'm Simi Golestani. I am grateful that the Oriens Award exists because I think that it's very important as trauma surgeons, in addition to focusing on scientific research, to really take a moment to kind of come back to why we all do this as a profession. And for me, writing has always been my way of processing and kind of remembering and honoring the stories of patients who were not able to do as much as we could want to do. But I think it's also a way of remembering our motivation for this job, which is to do as much good as we can for as many people as we can.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for your time and congratulations.
Thank you. Hi, this is Mohammed Bawazir. We just finished a very exciting session about updates in evidence-based care and the most recent EAST PMGs and clinical care pathways. I have here with me Dr. Patacharya. He presented his most recent guidelines. Can you please tell us about your guidelines to study?
Sure. So basically, we as a group at our institution decided to prioritize robotic surgery in our acute care group. We do both acute care and some elective surgery. And we decided to prioritize it for two reasons. One, we wanted to be able to offer this to our patients. And two, we wanted to be able to incorporate this with our resident education because we realized that most of their robotics exposure was on the thoracic service. And we thought that was not doing them any favors because when they get out, they're going to want to be able to do robotics and general surgery. So prior to my arrival, there was a robotics task force that joined. It was a group of hospital administrators, surgeons, OR staff, OR management, trying to increase access to the robot, including after-hours access. And there were several of us that were new to our group because we were rebuilding our division. And we realized that it was very challenging to get access to the robot because, as you know, a lot of acute care surgery happens after hours or late start cases or after 7 p.m. And so we wanted to make sure we still had the ability to offer robotic surgery to our patients if we thought this was an appropriate tool tool to use for them based on whatever their clinical reasoning, our clinical reasoning was. And so with the robotic task force, we were able to initiate implementation of an after-hours utilization of the robotic surgery platform. And we hypothesized that we would have increased access and likely decreased operative times as we became more proficient on the robot, because we were able to use it more often and not just during our scheduled block time, which was 1 or 2 days a week, and we were sharing it among multiple surgeons, so our utilization was less. And we did find that we were able to increase both access and decrease our operative times on some index cases. We looked at cholecystectomies and inguinal hernia repairs, because those are pretty straightforward cases, the same steps for all of them. It's not like a ventral abdominal hernia that may have different levels of if you're going to do an IPUM or you're going to do some sort of component separation. So we looked at those two specific cases and found that our operative times decreased.
That's fantastic. How did you overcome the system logistics in terms of staff training? Everyone is comfortable doing robotics after hours.
Well, I have to say that this was definitely teamwork. So our robotics task force consisted of operating room management, nursing staff, administration, a lot of surgeons who were very invested, and it was a group effort. We also relied heavily on our intuitive group. Their reps were very interested in helping us get trained. As a surgeon, in addition to the normal training that I had to do to become robotics certified, I did additional sort of troubleshooting training. I can set up a robot from start to finish if there was no one there that could do it or could troubleshoot someone else doing it. So you have to be the expert in the room to make this successful and to make everyone else comfortable. There was a lot of hand-holding. There was a lot of patience and grace given to people as they were learning the process. So you can't be a surgeon who sort of flies off the handle and gets frustrated easily when you're implementing this type of process, because then no one wants to do it. And so there was a lot of multidisciplinary effort and a lot of patience.
That's fantastic. Congratulations on your work, and thank you for your time. Thank you for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This is Mohamed Bouazir. I have Dr. Marcelo Ribeiro. He presented a study about the association between whole blood versus balanced component therapy and survival in isolated severe traumatic brain injury. Dr. Ribeiro, thank you for your time and for being with us today.
Thank you.
Can you please give us a brief summary about your study?
Yes, so the aim of the study was to compare the survival rates and in-hospital mortality for patients sustaining isolated traumatic brain injuries that receive whole blood versus component therapy.
And what was the hypothesis?
So the hypothesis that the patients receiving whole blood would have an improved survival rate comparing to the patients who received one-to-one-to-one transfusion therapy. That was the main hypothesis of our study.
What were the results of the study?
So the results, although it's a retrospective analysis of the TQIP, the results were very optimistic, showing that patients who received whole blood, they presented a better survival rate when comparing to patients who received one-to-one-to-one therapy.
And congratulations on your work. Did you implement this in practice already, transfusing whole blood for traumatic brain injuries?
Yes, I was very honored to be the first trauma surgeon in Brazil to start whole blood. And then now in UAE, our service is also the first service in UAE to have whole blood. So we are very excited. We already started the whole blood transfusion therapy for our trauma patients. And we're looking forward now to the prospective analysis that we're going to do for traumatic brain injury for patients receiving whole blood.
Very good. Any future plans to continue this research endeavor?
Definitely. I think we need, in order to be able to prove that this is a correct hypothesis, we need to get a prospective study. So we are planning to do a multicentric trial comparing whole blood to this one-to-one-to-one therapy for traumatic brain injury patients.
Excellent. Congratulations again on your work. Thank you for your time, for being with us today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is Melissa Warte. I'm here with Rachel Carey, who presented on pre-hospital under-triage rates that can improve with implementation of a novel EMS educational module. She's from Rutgers, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, and I would like her to introduce herself and how she got interested in this project.
Sure. Hi, thanks for being here. So I am a third-year medical student. I go to Rutgers, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, interested in both trauma surgery and emergency medicine. My background has been mostly in pre-hospital EMS. I was also an EMT myself, so I feel like that kind of is where it started. So out of personal interest, I was shadowing once in the emergency department, and on the loudspeaker, I heard an announcement for a Trauma Bravo that was actually an upgrade to a Trauma Alpha. So immediately in my head, I was like, oh, I wonder how that's going to affect patient care. it seems like maybe people are now scrambling to get together and to organize. So that's more of a personal interest, more of like an institutional interest. Under triage has historically been an issue at our trauma center. Every few years, the ACS verification committee will come and see us and see, okay, are we meeting our criteria to actually be a certified level one trauma center? And our most recent trauma site survey wasn't the greatest, for full disclosure, wasn't the best. We have had a lot of patients who come in and they're really an alpha, but they're getting triage as a Bravo or Charlie. So both personal and institutional interest.
So you started this novel system by going out to your local EMS and also Robert Wood's own EMTs. And you found that you were able to reduce your under triage rates to close to 2%, which is phenomenal. But how did that affect your over triage rates? Did you look at that?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. We did not look at over triage. We decided to focus on under triage because in trauma systems, under triage is like the more feared outcome because it's related to mortality. Over triage is a whole separate kind of thing. It is not as much associated with mortality, but what it is associated with is greater healthcare costs, greater maybe burden on the healthcare system, just overall more utilization of resources. At a level one or maybe even a level two trauma center, you have a ton of resources. It's just how are you going to utilize them? Indications for further research, definitely over triage would be one of them.
Right. And I come from a Catholic healthcare system that is a level two. We function like a level one and that we have all of the resources, but at the same time, they are limited and financials are limited. So you definitely need to be cognizant of that. But again, then you weigh that against patient mortality, and right, it's always a difficult balance. You know, this was a really novel approach. How would you expand your program, though, to maybe beyond just your local healthcare system, maybe to the county and or state levels?
Yeah, so this was a single center study. We only contacted agencies who transport to us at our center. We have over 150 agencies who actually transport to us, which is a huge amount. There were some difficulties contacting them. Not every EMS agency was able to be reached and also educated. You can imagine we have thousands of EMTs who transport to our center. There are a few trauma centers in the state of New Jersey. Right now, we just looked at our own, but expansion to the state level could include like communication with those other trauma centers and maybe coordinating our criteria to be the same. Each trauma center develops its own criteria, but perhaps if stakeholders are interested, we can make the triage criteria the same, which would create more simplicity for EMS so they're not confused when they're going to more than one trauma center and they don't know the triage criteria because they're different. So I think the expansion would involve lots of like communication with other trauma centers.
That's an excellent point. And previously it was the CDC field triage guidelines. Now it's moved over to the Department of, I believe, Transportation now sets them. And our state bylaws said we had to go by CDC guidelines. So some of that's getting changed at the state level. So that I think will be helpful for at least our state. But I do agree that the educational portion is always a challenge. What kind of module did you use to do this education?
So this was just a simple Microsoft PowerPoint class. And we went in person. I delivered all the classes. And I also started off by saying I was an EMT. I was in your shoes. I think that kind of helps with bridging barriers. Kind of gives the EMS like an idea, oh, she's done it before. Now she's in medical school. So she's not like a chair of a hospital. So it's more of a bridge. And it was just very informal, to be honest. We said, here's our criteria. What do you think? We gave the opportunity for them to ask questions. We even went through different case scenarios. We talked to them about why, even though a patient gets a tourniquet from major hemorrhage, they're an alpha, even if that hemorrhage is controlled. Previously, an alpha wasn't for a tourniquet, but we modified it and now it is. And we talked about just because you get a tourniquet and the bleeding is controlled, they still had major bleeding in the first place. That's why it's an alpha. So it was kind of informal and served as an opportunity for them to ask questions. And I would say it's easily reproducible. Again, I wasn't financially compensated. I just did it on my own time. And it was pretty easy, honestly. Once we actually made contact with the agency, the classes were very easy to actually execute. And they were about an hour in length each time.
That's excellent. I think our injury prevention coordinator does a lot of that. I've gone out with him to some of the places to review trauma triage guidelines, et cetera. So I think this is definitely a seed starter, if you will, for something that we can expand to beyond your healthcare system and throughout our state. So I thank you for your presentation today and your insights. Have a great rest of your conference.
Thank you so much.
Good morning, everyone. This is Melissa Warte. I'm here with Tara Van Deen, who is from Inova Fairfax Hospital, who just presented in the Quick Shots session here at East. Tara, could you introduce yourself to us and a little bit about how you got interested in your study?
Sure. I'm Tara Van Veen, like was said, I'm a chief resident at Inova Fairfax Hospital. And we started this study mostly because we didn't have a standard protocol at our hospital of how long we should really leave chest tubes in and how long the water seal trial should be. And then it kind of blossomed the idea into a multi-center study that we had 27 centers participate in. And it was really interesting to see the variation in practice between different centers and hoping to standardize that for everyone and have good evidence-based data to back it up.
It was a really interesting talk about the talking points on how long you should leave a chest tube on water seal and what were your reinsertion rates, et cetera. But I did have one question about this, and you talked offline with me that all the centers had to have protocols in place. But what were the sort of reasons that maybe they left chest tubes in longer? Did you find any consistency with just documented, say, persistent air leaks or pneumothoraces? And do you have any insight as to why maybe the longer length of water seal actually had worse outcomes in some of those areas?
So I think that we could have collected a little bit better data in some areas because anyone who just didn't have the chest tube removed was considered a water seal trial failure. So while I think some of them were put back to suction because of recurrent pneumothoraces, things like that, there may have also been some level of kind of convenience if the water seal trial was done at the end of the day, just waiting till the morning to remove the chest tube. And I think that kind of contributes also to why there was some worsening outcomes for the long water seal trials. So I think that it's something to look forward in the future. And especially for this, I'm hopeful that we can look at just isolated thoracic trauma to really evaluate if this could change length of stay for kind of patients with isolated rib fractures and pneumothoraces, because I think it had less of an impact for our patients that came in with extensive polytrauma.
Fair. And so if you had one take-home message for everybody who's trying to write a new practice management guideline, what would your advice be?
My advice would be for isolated thoracic trauma with pneumothorax, as long as there's no air leak, that an 8-hour water seal trial should be safe for their patients.
Excellent. Well, again, it was a great talk. I think it's always an area of great debate for everybody, and I appreciate you taking your time with us today.
Okay, thank you so much.
I'm here with Grace Keegan after her amazing talk during the Cox Templeton Injury Prevention Paper Competition. Grace, can you just give a brief summary of your work?
Sure. We interviewed people who identify as female working in violence intervention and outreach through community programs, and wanted to identify their strengths that they add to violence intervention teams, their needs, as well as the challenges that they face related to the work and related to their identities as female.
Okay. What do you see after your work as the benefit of having females on this team?
We found through our study that females provide a different approach to the work that offers the opportunity for their mostly male clients to open up and become more emotionally vulnerable, which can in turn lead to disclosures of past traumas and start the healing process for many of those histories of trauma, and just a more therapeutic approach that in the end might help disrupt some cycles of toxic masculinity that lead to future violence or masculine reinforcing behaviors.
What do you think we can do to increase recruitment of those that identify as female into this workforce to help us with these efforts?
I think you could approach that from two angles. Because the work in the community is very much by and for people who have been affected by violence, working networks and having the people who are identify as female recruit other people that they know within the communities, because that's how a lot of the work happens. And then also from a leadership standpoint, the people that lead these programs can also prioritize hiring more women. As I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, some of the original programs focused really only on hiring men, thinking that was the key to solving this problem of gang violence as a mostly male phenomenon. Hiring women, it turns out, may add some additional strengths to these teams. So bringing this research to the leadership and changing the hiring strategies of these programs.
Thank you, Grace. Really great work.
Thank you.
I'm here with Kendra Black from UC San Diego after her Cox Templeton injury prevention talk. Kendra, can you just give me a brief summary of your work?
Yes, so we were looking at rates of e-scooter injuries in San Diego and advocating for increased rules and regulations. Then we tracked these injury rates and found that they significantly decreased after we implemented regulations like speed limits, geofencing, and limiting the number of companies allowed in San Diego County. this decreased injury rates quite significantly, more than 60%. And now e-scooters are not allowed in San Diego County at all. So I think we've been successful in limiting those.
Do you think this is something that we could replicate in other cities across the country?
I do. I think it's going to be city-specific and trauma-regional-specific as the different regulations vary per city, but I do think that other centers would be able to mimic this study.
And what barriers do you think are in place in many of these places to prevent this from happening?
I think the biggest barrier are the personally owned electric vehicles, either scooters or e-bikes, as we can't regulate those as well. And everything has a motor now, so they have electric scooters, skateboards, hoverboards, bicycles, everything like that. And so with those increased speeds, it just increases injury rates.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Black. Really great work.
Appreciate it.
I'm here with Dr. Harfouche from Shock Trauma to discuss her presentation from the Cox Templeton Injury Prevention Paper Competition. Dr. Harfouche, would you mind providing us a summary of your work?
Yes, of course. And thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today, Dr. Dower. My study was titled Engaging Young Black Men in Mental Health Services. And these were young black men who were admitted to our trauma center who had experienced gun violence. And although originally we aimed to enroll an 18 to 24 age group, we ultimately broadened it to all black men who had experienced gun violence. The study was conducted over a period of 1.5 years. And we administered 45 minutes of questions to these individuals to get their perceptions on mental health services, whether they had participated in them in the past, and what they felt like could be barriers to engaging, particularly the 18 to 24 age group, in the mental health services. In addition, we also did an hour-long focus group with our hospital-based violence intervention program caseworkers and our community violence intervention specialists.
What do you think we can do to help decrease the stigma around mental health services for these patients?
So a lot of what we found from our interviews with our patients was that there is this perception that therapy is not for violence. Violence is very much normalized in these communities, and it was felt that these services were more for romantic problems or problems within the family. And I think we certainly as healthcare providers can talk to our patients and help them recognize that what they've experienced is a real problem. There are services in the community that we can offer them.
What do you think is the responsibility of the hospitals and health systems, as well as the local and state governments, in providing mental health services for our patients?
I think we all know that health outcomes are very much linked to socioeconomic status, and racial inequities, particularly in Baltimore, where this study was implemented, are highly influential in our patients' outcomes. So we are, as hospitals, as trauma centers, are committed to improving the health of our community, and we have to be involved in the socioeconomic aspects of that.
Thank you.
My name is Tatiana Cardenas. I'm here at the 37th Annual Scientific Assembly with Dr. Christina Feather, who presented at the scientific session today about wound closure for non-trauma emergency colorectal surgeries. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of what it was that you presented?
Sure. This was a East multi-institutional study that looked at wound management techniques at fascial closure in non-trauma emergent colorectal surgery, really looking at providing some more tools for surgeons on how to make that decision at fascial closure of what to do with the skin. Should we close the skin? Should we loosely close the skin? And should we open the skin? And we found that closing the skin in these patients is really a viable option and allowing us as surgeons who are risk averse to really be more confident and going in that decision route, which might have some additional benefits for patients in the long term.
That's awesome. That's a very interesting finding. And I really like the fact they honed in on these colorectal patients because they tend to have the higher sort of risk for SSIs and infections. What do you think are next steps? Where do you think we're going with this? Is this implementable right now? How are you approaching this for the future?
I think for right now, I think surgeons at least can have it in their toolbox when they're having decision making at the bedside. But I think also we have to recognize that this is one decision amongst many decisions that we make when taking care of wounds. And what do we do after that? What's the next best decision to make? Should we put vacs on everybody? Should we not put vacs on everybody? If we do have to keep their skin open, should all of those patients have their skin closed subsequent? What are the next decisions that we should be making to really provide the best path to wound healing with the most efficient way for our patients?
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This is pretty exciting stuff. I look forward to future studies.
Thanks.
My name is Tatiana Cardenas, and I'm talking to Dr. Patrick Griffenstein about his research on and the effects of that in animal models. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of what your work that you presented today at the scientific session?
Sure. We've had the question of what CPR actually does in the setting of trauma, the futility of it, and sort of those overall questions that people have been trying to ask for a long time. We were particularly interested in how CPR affects a heart that is beating but isn't beating hard enough to generate a pulse because it doesn't have enough preload. So this is a pulseless victim who has cardiac activity and usually hyperdynamic cardiac activity. And this happens on occasion. We wanted to see what CPR might do to that particular condition. We studied it in large swine model of controlled hemorrhage, and what we found is that when we brought these animals down to mean arterial pressure of less than 30, that consistent with other studies, the addition of CPR increased systolic blood pressure but dropped diastolic blood pressure. So the net effect on mean arterial pressure was negligible. So in terms of perfusion, it would potentially not do anything. More interestingly, though, when we looked at markers of perfusion, particularly oxygenation at the tissue in the brain and at the skin, we found that there was a difference during shock when the animals got CPR. It did appear to blunt their perfusion, oxygenation in the tissue. But more interestingly, that difference actually got wider during the recovery phase. So we allowed the animals to recover after resuscitation and then just maintain normal tension for an hour. And the animals that had received CPR, their oxygen tension in the tissue, the brain, and the skin was actually significantly lower than the animals that didn't. So it just points to, number one, the fact that hemodynamically CPR doesn't appear to augment mean arterial pressure in severe hemorrhagic shock. And number two, with a beating heart, that it doesn't actually help perfusion, may hinder perfusion, and that there are actually long-term effects or persistent effects after resuscitation. The clinical significance of that really has yet to be teased out.
So what are next steps as we look and move forward in this?
Yeah, so the next steps for our lab is to look at what cardiac output actually is in our model, and couple that with maybe some other markers of perfusion. Particularly, we're looking at tissue perfusion biomarkers using injectable microspheres. So these are labeled microspheres that you can inject at various points in time in an experiment, and then later on analyze the concentration of these different isotopes in the tissue and get an idea of what the relative perfusion was at that time. So it's a pretty slick science that we're hoping to implement with the next round of animals. In terms of overall, I think that when we're doing these studies and looking at the analysis of what's out there in terms of the science behind the use of CPR and trauma, really isn't very well established. In fact, I would say the preponderance of evidence suggests that it probably shouldn't be done. So I think that what it begs us to do is to get better at analyzing what is going on with these patients. And the patients that overwhelmingly survive in our institution and in published literature are the patients who have cardiac activity. What we need to do is we need to identify those patients as early as possible. The best way to do that is put ultrasound probes in the hands of EMS providers So in New Orleans right now, my colleague Dave Rayburn, who's head of New Orleans EMS, our physician, he's implementing a trial of training and utilization of ultrasound in New Orleans EMS providers so we can begin to assess cardiac activity and pulselessness in the field, both trauma and non-trauma, and using the ultrasound to guide resuscitation. And if the patient has cardiac activity that appears to be effective, then maybe let's not do CPR. Let's focus on other things. Mm-hmm. So rather than distracting our intervention towards doing CPR and all the complications of that, because, you know, trying to get lines and tubes and things in somebody who's getting pounded on by an automated machine may not be the most effective way to do it. So I think that the goal should be to reprioritize the resuscitation in the critically injured patient. Let's look at the heart, and when the heart's beating, let's let the heart do what it does, and let's focus on getting blood back in the patient. Let's focus on hemostasis. Let's focus on airway. Let's focus on these other things that actually could help the patient in the setting of a heart that's doing its job.
Awesome. Well, this is really exciting stuff. I look forward to your future studies, and thank you so much for taking the time. Excellent talk.
Cool. Thank you very, very much.
Hi everyone, this is Melissa Warte. I am here with Melissa Anderson at the EAST Annual Conference, and I'm going to have Melissa introduce herself and tell you a little bit about the paper she presented at the scientific session today.
Thank you. So my name is Missy Anderson. I'm the Pediatric Trauma Program Manager for Denver Health, and the paper I presented today was entitled Stop the Bleed for Kids, a Pediatric Approach to a National Education Initiative.
So tell me a little bit about how you got involved in that and how successful do you think this program is?
It was actually very simple. I got a call from a nurse. I agreed to something that I didn't ask questions about, which was, could I teach Stop the Bleed to her Girl Scout, her daughter's Girl Scout troop? I said yes, and then failed to ask how old these children were. Come to find out, they were 9 years old. So I had to go to my thinking board, create a curriculum that was appropriate for children. So to date, I've been doing this since 20, and I've trained roughly 6,000 kids between Southern California and the state of Colorado. And I was able to retest a very small group of those kids and got 75% as a retention rate after 1 year. I do think this is a successful program. I get calls daily. I just need more data to back and get more retention on these kids.
Well, I think it's great, and as the pediatric TMD at my program, I've been asked the same thing for my own daughter's Girl Scout troop, and she is 9, and trying to figure out how to do that. I wish I'd known you existed before they asked me that question, and I said, I have to figure this out. So I think it's amazing. And how can people get in touch with you, or how can they get a copy of what looked like a really awesome book to share with kids?
Yeah, so the best way is to probably email me, which I'll tell you my email. It's Melissa, M-E-L-I-S-S-A, Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, at dhha.org.
Again, an amazing endeavor, and I think it's something that you should probably also push out to the ACS, because I think it would be a great addition to the armamentarium of Stop the Bleed, although if you listen to some of the Maddox conferences, some people debate the validity and how much we should use it and teach tourniquets. But again, I think the little sponges can absorb it in the right lingo, so I really appreciate you giving us a verbiage for that for them.
Yep, thank you so much, and please feel free to reach out to me at any time.
Awesome. Enjoy the rest of your conference, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Hi everyone, this is Melissa Warte. I am here at the EAST Annual Scientific Assembly, and I am with one of our orthopedic colleagues, Dr. Nishant Goel, hopefully I said his name right, who's going to talk to us a little bit about the paper he presented looking at patient characteristics who have a delay to the OR for their orthopedic injuries. Nishant, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in this topic?
Sure, thanks for having me on the podcast. So this was something that I had started back in 2017, 2018 during my research year. And we were seeing that there was a patient population, specifically people with femur fractures, that were having delays to fixation. And we were trying to understand why that was happening. And there could be a whole host of different factors, surgeon factors, and then ultimately also patient factors. And so we wanted to delve a little bit more into that. So in this study in particular, we looked at both femur fractures and tibial shaft fractures and found that, you know, there are a lot of patient characteristics that do delay them to go to the operating room. And this is not quite reflected in our reports that we have on reasons why these patients are being delayed. And so the reason we conducted this study is to see what those patient characteristics are and can we adjust who we're including in the denominator in the group that we're studying to better assess these trauma centers and better provide them with reports that truly show what the actual landscape of fixation for these femur and tibia fractures is.
Excellent. Well, I think it's something that all trauma centers sort of struggle with, especially like the elderly femur fracture. As the discussant of your paper alluded to, there's a lot of unnecessary cardiac workup. I think a lot of places are trying to come up with isolated hip and femur fracture protocols to limit some of that. How would you propose, or what sort of protocols would you maybe propose to help trauma centers expedite the appropriate care of these patients, getting them to the OR quicker, sooner, in a more timely manner? Is there anything that you could pinpoint that might help that process based on what you've learned so far?
Yeah, so as far as protocols to put in place to get these patients to the OR faster, I think it is really evaluating these patients as a whole, seeing what those patient characteristics are that are leading to delays. Are they the actual ones that should delay patients, or should they not delay patients? And then part of that protocol would also be, like you've alluded to, trying to eliminate the unnecessary workup in some of these patients. And I think there's been a few studies that have looked at that as well. And so adopting that kind of more broadly, I think, would really help trauma centers in general as a whole.
Excellent. Well, again, I think this was a great topic and a great collaboration that shows that just, I think, orthopedic trauma and surgery trauma, general surgery trauma, probably need to collaborate a little bit more. And hopefully maybe we can see our two branches, if you will, of trauma collaborate more and get these patients the better and faster care that they need. So thanks for taking the time to talk with me, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Tatiana Cardenas, and I'm here with Dr. Rachel Choron, who just presented on the EAST multicenter trial of post-op enteral nutrition after duodenal repair. Could you just kind of describe a little bit of what you presented and what you found?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm Rachel Choron. I'm from Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School in New Brunswick, New Jersey. So we did a 35-center multicenter trial. It was a retrospective analysis, and this was the post hoc analysis of that initial study. And so we looked at patients who had duodenal injuries and then had surgical repairs and then who leaked. So there was 113 patients, and then we stratified them by nutrition strategy. So enteral nutrition versus parenteral nutrition versus both, and we looked at outcomes. And so the main three outcomes we wanted to know about were infectious complications, length of stay, and then the duration until leak closure. And so we found that the enteral nutrition group had better outcomes for all of those categories.
Awesome. So what we were talking offline a little bit, what is your takeaway? How are you changing your practice? I mean, this is a huge lift, doing this study and being able to really identify these outcomes. What's your takeaway?
I think my takeaway is that while we already know that enteral nutrition has some advantages, and we showed that again with this study, I do think that when you get a leak, some people will automatically be like, okay, well, the treatment here is parenteral nutrition. So I think we showed that parenteral nutrition did not improve duration until leak closure. And so I think you don't have to automatically give parenteral nutrition to all leak patients, and enteral nutrition is acceptable and you can proceed with that.
Awesome. Any next steps or future studies in the works?
Great question. You know, I think the offline, like we were talking about, the feeding tubes and the placement of these feeding tubes in relation to the leak site and anatomically speaking, I think that's the question that was a limitation in this paper, as we didn't have that data. And to me, that would be really fascinating to look at.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on a great presentation and a successful assembly.
Thank you so much for having me.
You got it.
That wraps up another episode of TraumaCast, brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Visit east.org to check out all the great educational and career development resources we have to offer, and make sure you subscribe to the TraumaCast series so you don't miss any of our exciting upcoming programs or interviews. If you're searching for cutting-edge science, professional education, networking, and career development, remember, all you need to do is look to the east.